Morning. Begin our January calendar of cases. And we're delighted today to welcome students from Barneveld High School. Would they please stand? Thank you. You may be seated. The students are here today with a program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. It's a national award-winning program. Students from around the state are invited to come to an oral argument. If they come, they are sent the briefs in the case that they will hear. They may engage in some activities relating to the case. And then after the second case in the morning, the students meet with a justice to discuss the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the case. Everyone is invited to come to that session, which will be at around noon today. If you would like a summary of the case you're about to hear, and it makes listening to the case much easier, the marshal can give you a summary. So if you'd raise your hand if you'd like a summary of the case. Let me now introduce the court to you all. Seated to my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. She is the justice with whom you will meet at about noon. To her right is Justice David Prosser. To his right is Justice Lewis Butler. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his left is Justice Patience Rogensack. And on the far left is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call our first case, which is 06-AP-396, James R. Donahue versus Action Wisconsin. Arguing on behalf of Action Wisconsin is Tamara Packard. Ms. Packard.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I am Tamara Packard, and I appear with my partner, Lester Pines, on behalf of the petitioner, Action Wisconsin. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I could.
Yes, you will get 5 minutes, and according to my notes, Mr. Pines will do the rebuttal. Is that correct? Would you stand closer to the microphone so that we're sure to hear you? Go ahead.
Maybe if I move the mic toward me a little better? Okay. This case is about sanctioning an attorney for bringing and pursuing a frivolous public figure defamation case. It's also about something much bigger than that. It's about the public policy of encouraging free and open political debate, which is embodied in the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, as well as Article 1, Section 3 of the Wisconsin Constitution. The actual malice standard, which is a central issue in this case, is based on that constitutional privilege of free speech. Public figure defamation law is rooted in First Amendment free speech jurisprudence, and I'm sure you've reviewed New York Times versus Sullivan, St. Ament, and Roth versus United States, for example, as cases that do a very excellent job in explaining why the free speech of people, particularly on issues of the day, needs to be protected. It is founded on the sentiment that when public figures participate in the discourse regarding topics of the day and then disagree with another participant's interpretation of what they say, those public figures must keep talking. They must correct the interpretation and contribute to the discussion. They must keep that discourse going. They should not stop that discourse, shut that discourse down by suing. When disputes begin in public, the policy behind free speech is that the dispute should continue in public. The response to objectionable speech is more speech, and the public figure, as a public figure, is in an excellent position to engage in that speech at a public level. That is what the actual malice standard is designed to ensure. Now, the posture of this case is this. It comes to you on appeal of a motion awarding a decision awarding sanctions. The circuit court's dismissal on the merits was not appealed. That decision on the merits was decided on cross motions for summary judgment. In that decision on the merits, the trial judge, Judge McMahon of Milwaukee County Circuit Court, determined that there were no material facts in dispute, and indeed neither party contended that there were any material facts in dispute. She also determined that there were no facts to support the element of actual malice, and that the defendant's interpretation of the public figure's statements was rational, fair, as well as not unreasonable.
Ms. Packard, I know that there was a motion for reconsideration, and that seems to have triggered the attorney's fees issue. Was the motion for reconsideration in any way appealed?
No.
It's clear that from the record that it was not appealed.
It's very clear from the record that it was not appealed. The motion, the sanctions motion was actually filed back in April of 2004 along with Action Wisconsin's answer. And the briefing on the motions was done after the decision on the merits was done. As back in April of 2004, the expectations were file your motion, have it held in abeyance until the merits are determined, and then go forward on the briefing of the motion. And that's the procedure that we followed in this case.
You gave the plaintiffs an opportunity to settle
yes,
the case.
A number of times.
And advising them that you were going in for frivolous costs. If they did not.
Yes, Chief Justice. We, when we filed our motion for sanctions back in April of 2004, we also sent a letter to Attorney Donahue advising him that we believed that the case was frivolous and outlining a number of bases for our feelings on that. We provided him with another letter after we took his client's deposition, again outlining why we believed the case was frivolous and asking him to dismiss. And I believe at that point we asked only for very minimal costs.
But we don't have it.
This is all governed by the former provisions, not the new provisions relating to safe harbor, et cetera.
It's correct that the new rules didn't go in. Well, they didn't become new rules until later. Actually, under the old rules, there were no warnings and no safe harbors expected. The fact is that we believed it was only fair to provide him with the kind of information that we did.
Now, are you going in under the Section 814, which deals with what, continuation, or under the 802 frivolous, which deals with, if I remember correctly, both the filing and the maintenance?
We brought our motion under both sections.
And the circuit court ruled, one, that the immediate filing was frivolous as well as continuing?
That's correct.
What's the standard of review for that decision of the circuit court?
We believe that the standard of review is an erroneous exercise of discretion standard. Under 814.025, there have been there's case law that says that the continuing a case without basis in law or fact should be reviewed with an eye to erroneous exercise of discretion with regard to the findings of fact, but then in terms of applying those facts to law, that should be a de novo review. It appears that under the new rule, because the new rule is the 805 rule, 805.07, mm-hmm. that it is purely under the new rule a erroneous exercise review.
So there's a different review for the 802, whatever that number is, and the 814.
It appears so, but again,
the way I read Jernt.
Sorry?
That's the way I read Jernt.
Yes, and I agree that Jernt sets it up that way, and I'm sorry I can't tell you which case it was, but there was then a later case that said that you look at these things in the same way, whether they're under 814 or 80205.
It's an erroneous exercise of discretion, which gives the trial court, which puts a heavy hand on the trial court's decision on review.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the problems in this case, it seems to me, is the original summary judgment was against the client. Right?
That's correct.
The frivolous matter was against the attorney.
That's correct.
I was trying to check the record and make sure it was against the lawyer, but that's the way the briefs read to me, and that's what I understand the case to be.
That's correct.
So the client says, okay, I lost that one, and folds its tent and goes home. But the lawyer has a different kind of issue. So what happens? Can the lawyer now attack that summary judgment as being invalid, even though the lawyer was not a party to that summary judgment? There's no one else is appealing that summary judgment?
In the context of the motion for sanctions, the lawyer should put out every single fact that he developed both before he filed the lawsuit and after he filed the lawsuit, and every single piece of law that he identified that gave him the sense that he had a case that was well-grounded in law or fact. In that way, the lawyer does get to, in a sense, re-argue the merits, but it's under a different standard. It's did the lawyer, the frame is based on the lawyer's behavior. The frame is did the lawyer identify facts? Did the lawyer identify law that gave this case a fair grounding, a reasonable grounding in fact and in law? So it's not a re-argument of the merits, and in fact, that was one of the problems that we had with the Court of Appeals decision. It's not a fresh look at the merits. Instead, it's a look at the facts and the law that was developed by the attorney in the course of the litigation. And in fact, it's unnecessary to go back at the merits again, because every single piece of evidence, every single piece of law, every analysis that the attorney did in the process of representing this client should be brought forward. If he hasn't already brought that forward in the course of summary judgment motions, this is the time for him to bring that up in defending himself against a sanctions motion. If this were a case where there were a series,
show that there's reasonable ground in fact and law that he had
exactly
when he filed and maintained or maintained.
Yes, exactly. And if this were a case where there were a serious dispute over, a serious legal dispute, whether these facts could or couldn't support, for instance, in our case, a finding of actual malice, it's the sanctions motion where that would have been brought out. Mr. Donahue, Attorney Donahue, would have pointed to cases that show the difference between losing on the merits but having an argument and simply having no basis in law or fact.
So just because you lose a summary judgment doesn't mean it's a frivolous matter.
Exactly. They're very different standards, Your Honor. You can lose on summary judgment but have an argument. And in this case, we believe Mr. Donahue never had an argument. There was never any law that he was able to point to that supported the facts that he said met actual malice. We're not asking you to tie the hands of the appellate courts. We encourage the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court to review the question of frivolousness, though, and not go beyond that, not reach the merits when that's not before the court. The appellate courts may look at the record as it reflects the facts and the law identified by the attorney, but they need not and should not look at the merits again. Unfortunately, that's exactly what the Court of Appeals did when it said such things as that the trial court erroneously decided disputed issues of fact and that the case should have gone to a fact finder for determination on actual malice.
Counselor, that is part of what has concerned me in this case, because I'm not sure how you cannot look at disputed issues of fact if, in fact, the facts in one direction would show an investigation was properly done and those facts were subject to dispute. So unless the facts are beyond dispute, don't you really have to look at them to see what he did and whether he properly investigated before the lawsuit was filed?
Well, first of all, there really weren't any facts in dispute. We did not dispute any of the facts that Attorney Donahue contended supported his element of actual malice.
Did you assume that everything that was said in the complaint was true as you started out?
Every factual allegation, yes.
Okay.
What Attorney Donahue pointed to is supporting the actual malice element, which is a legal question, was that they asked for retraction and Action Wisconsin didn't retract, didn't respond. That Action Wisconsin did not go to Reverend Storms ahead of time before publishing and ask whether their interpretation of his words was correct. The third point that he pointed to, which we don't disagree, was the content of the press release and the content of the speech. Those are pretty solidly established facts. We've got the recording in the record, and we have the press release in the record. He also pointed to the fact that is undisputed that the parties hold opposing views on gay rights. And the fifth fact that he relied on to reach actual malice was that two of the staff members of Action Wisconsin didn't listen to the whole speech. It's also uncontested, though, that the president of Action Wisconsin, the highest-ranking person at Action Wisconsin, did listen to the whole speech, and it was at his request that the press release was written and posted.
Do you think that there's, at least from what I understand from the arguments, part of what is being said here is that if you had listened to the whole tape, and apparently he had other people listen to the whole disc or whatever it is, the speech, that it would be a disputed fact about whether or not there was an advocate and whether Storms was advocating killing gay people. Does that bear on actual malice? In other words, if you listen to the tape, and you could have come to a conclusion different than what is set out in Action Wisconsin's press release and the poster that they have where they say he advocated murdering gay people. If you could have come to a different conclusion, does that bear on actual malice?
The standard of actual malice requires that it be subjectively proven that either the speaker knew that the statement was false or had a strong suspicion that their statement was false, and it's a subjective test. So, no, I don't believe that while that other people listening to the same speech might come to other conclusions, I don't believe that would support the standard of actual malice.
Even if the statement were false, it still might not be defamatory.
Exactly.
It could have been a totally false impression of of Storm's speech. Totally false.
It could be a totally false interpretation of the speech
incorrect.
Totally incorrect.
Yeah, there's a difference between false and incorrect, I think.
I think that the justice is right. Totally incorrect.
And that's
that
the
isn't
difference.
What makes it defamatory. What makes it defamatory is that it was done with malice.
The actual malice standard is a special standard that applies only to public figure defamation cases, which is the kind that we have here.
And that's not in dispute at the moment, is it?
That this was a public figure. It was never in dispute. Okay. It was never in dispute. We briefed
so you
it.
Need the actual
it
malice. So it could have been false. Could have been incorrect. But if it was done, but you didn't know it was false and you didn't have a strong suspicion that it was false, it's not defamatory when we're dealing with a public figure. That's the New York Times v. Sullivan.
Absolutely. That's absolutely correct.
Right.
As I understand it, counsel, Mr. Donahue sent letters to Action Wisconsin in January and February 2004. Basically asking for a retraction.
That's correct.
And were they answered?
No.
And what is the significance of the failure to answer those letters?
I don't think there's any significance to the failure of answering those letters. There's absolutely no case law out there that finds any significance in failure to answer a retraction letter. And in fact, in New York Times versus Sullivan, the argument was made that the failure to retract would potentially meet the actual malice standard. And the United States Supreme Court rejected that in that case, and they questioned whether it could ever constitute such evidence.
Well, there's a statute relating to newspapers that, that you have to ask them to retract before you bring a suit.
And that may be what he was applying, even though actually.
But it doesn't apply in this case, does it?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
Was your motion a motion based upon the commencement of the action itself or the continuance of the action, or both?
Both. Both. By deviating from the correct frame, the Court of Appeals answered questions about the merits of this case that the parties had not briefed before the appeals court, which is another problem, sort of above and beyond or in addition to the problem of going at the merits period. This caused the Court of Appeals to overlook controlling law regarding how circuit courts are to address public figure defamation cases, such as the Torgerson case, which favors disposition of these kinds of cases on summary judgment, especially on the element of actual malice, due to the free speech issues implicated in a public figure defamation case. It also caused the Court of Appeals to overlook the court's clear direction in Lewis versus Coracell Broadcasting, that whether or not actual malice exists is a question of law and not a fact. And I think that's where the Court of Appeals went off course. They determined there was a question of fact on actual malice. But in fact, there were no questions of fact on actual malice. It was a question of law that the trial court appropriately addressed according to the standards of Torgerson. Because neither party had ever claimed before the trial court that there were materials of disputes of fact, there wasn't even any briefing at the trial court level for the Court of Appeals to go back and look at to learn this rule of Lewis versus Coracell Broadcasting. So the lower courts need guidance from this court to show the proper frame in an appeal of a sanctions award. The second issue accepted for review, and I see my warning lights come on, so I got 5 minutes to cover this. The second issue is that the trial court is whether the trial court properly exercised discretion in deciding to sanction Attorney Donahue. The standard is set forth in Jandert versus Jerome Foods, and the trial court applied that standard. And this court, as we've already discussed, has to review that with deference. The circuit
may I ask counsel why did you go after Attorney Donahue as opposed to Pastor Storms for frivolousness?
Well, the duty to look at the law and look at the facts and analyze those things to determine whether there's a case that passes the smell test is an attorney's duty, and we believe that it was the attorney who needed to answer for that. It was the attorney we were communicating with all along from the very start of the case about the problems that he faced in trying to prosecute a public figure defamation case.
Who signed the complaint?
I'm sorry?
Who signed the complaint?
Who signed the complaint? Attorney Donahue did.
You know, I can't put my fingers on it for the moment, but when I read this, I thought that your original motion had both the attorney and the plaintiff.
That's correct.
And that the judge then held it to the attorney.
We ended up not briefing it to include the client.
But the original motion covered both. That's why I was somewhat concerned as to who that order meant.
We thought we'd better file the motion covering all our bases and figure out what we really wanted to do later on.
Policy-wise, when you focus on the attorney, aren't you really attempting to intimidate counsel from representing a controversial client?
No, Justice Prosser. We were attempting to encourage this attorney to meet his obligations as an attorney to do an appropriate evaluation of the facts and law. Attorneys have a very important role in the justice system as gatekeepers to the courthouse. And when we don't follow, when we don't complete our obligation under that, it creates problems for other litigants. It creates problems for the courts. It creates problems, obviously, for the other lawyers as well. We have a professional obligation to serve as a sentry at the courthouse door and make sure that we don't bring things that are a waste of people's time.
Can you explain to me again why the question of did the speech make reference to shooting gay people? Why the interpretation of that, someone would say, oh, the speech advocated the killing of gay people. Others would say, no, the speech is nothing more than an analogy to Samuel and Jonathan and his armor bearer. So there may be a difference in interpretation. Explain to me why that difference in interpretation is of no moment or is not important in the analysis with regard to actual malice. Because we have something competing here. Generally, we think, oh, we got some competing interpretations.
Certainly. Competing interpretations is not enough to meet the actual malice standard. And in fact, I don't think it's enough even to meet the truth or false standard. There's a case cited in my briefs, and I can't put my finger on it right away, that says when a defendant is accused of defamation based on their interpretation of ambiguous words, that doesn't constitute actual malice. That when it's ambiguous words and it's one of many interpretations, many potential interpretations, and throughout this we've given Mr. Storms, Reverend Storms, the benefit of the doubt that perhaps there are other interpretations of his speech, but our interpretation was at least one of many fair interpretations.
Well, is that of moment? That your interpretation is a fair interpretation. I say, so what? And I'm pushing you a little bit. Is that the inquiry, whether or not your interpretation is fair? Is it the inquiry whether your interpretation is right? Is that the inquiry?
The inquiry is whether it's fair. The courts should never be in the position of determining the truth of what someone's words are, what someone actually meant when they said what they said.
Well, I guess it depends on what you mean by fair, because it has a different couple of different interpretations. I thought the inquiry wasn't whether or not it's correct or it's fairly correct, but that the inquiry with regard to actual malice is whether the speaker knew that it was false or had a strong suspicion that it was false.
That's correct. On the actual malice standard, the question is, subjectively speaking, is there evidence to show that the speaker either knew that it was false or had strong suspicions that it was false? And there was absolutely no evidence to support that element ever introduced in this case, and there was no case law introduced in this case that suggested that the facts that Attorney Donahue believed supported actual malice actually did support actual malice. And one of the things that I'd like to point out is that Attorney Donahue believed a number of things that he found significant on the issue of actual malice, but he has never pointed to any case law that showed that his belief was founded in law. And in fact, Attorney Donahue's utter failure to comprehend the law of public figure defamation continues to be demonstrated in the brief that he filed with this court on page 19, okay, where he said that...
Sir, if I could just interrupt you, I have a question.
Sure.
Paragraph 6 of the complaint alleges certain quotes were made in Action Wisconsin's publications. And then paragraph 9 says that the quoted words in paragraph 6 of the complaint are false. And when I first started out asking you questions, you said that all the factual allegations in the complaint were uncontested, so you're taking them as true. I have difficulties with that, and maybe you do, and perhaps when you're sitting down before rebuttal, you might want to look at those paragraphs, and then maybe Mr. Pines might want to address them.
What I would say is that whether it was true or false is actually a legal element of the case. It's
well, you have quote. There are quotes around what concerned me in the complaint, and so either they were stated by Reverend Storms and were quoted correctly, or they were not, and I guess that's what kind of bothers me.
Reverend Storms did say the things that are alleged in the complaint, and Action Wisconsin did say the things that are alleged in the complaint. The legal conclusion as to whether what Action Wisconsin said in characterizing Reverend Storms' statements, whether that is true or false, is a legal conclusion.
Right. I see what you're saying. So you're saying that it's not a question of fact, even though you quoted him and quoted him incorrectly in your handout.
We quoted him correctly in our press release.
Okay, well, that's the complaint says you quoted him incorrectly. And it's the quoted part that's troubling me.
Okay.
I may not be making myself clear, but
if you don't
look at it, then maybe you can kind of see where I am.
Check number 8, which in the complaint says the statements contained in 6 were made and published by the defendants. Mm-hmm. The statements were and are false in that the statements contained in 6, although spoken by the plaintiff, they were spoken, were not made in reference to shooting gay people. So.
Right. That's what
statements were made.
Statements were made.
And
there's no question.
The interpretation is yours. Okay.
There's no question about who said what. The question is, was it a fair interpretation?
All right.
And the question is malice.
And a question of actual malice.
Well, that goes to malice, I think.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Your red light's been on.
Thank you.
Thank you for the extra time.
5 minutes in rebuttal. James R. Donahue.
Well, may it please the court, I know the old adage is that an attorney that represents himself has a fool for a client, but I guess I would point out that the adage doesn't say anything about the attorney himself, just the client. So since I'm just appearing as my own attorney and not as the client, I guess I'm not a fool today.
We'll see, counsel.
That's correct. Not potentially, not at least until I open my mouth. That's the other adage.
It's the proof, right?
That's right. Don't give them the evidence by opening your mouth. Here's the main points I have to make in this case. The first one that's crucial, obviously, is this case is about frivolous, not about whether the lawsuit should have been won, lost, was a weak case, was a close case. None of those things matter. All we're talking about was, did I have a reasonable basis to believe here that I had a legitimate lawsuit, to put it in the parlance? Now, the one thing I did want to respond to right away was when Attorney Packer talked about this more than one interpretation, more than one reasonable interpretation, and she referred to the Times case, and I think it might be in Torgerson. The catch to that is this. You only get into whether there's more than one reasonable interpretation if the speech is ambiguous. It's got to be ambiguous. If it's not ambiguous, you don't get there. Otherwise, we know what would happen. And that's that's maybe what's going to happen today. This court's obviously got to do what they think is best. But if this court doesn't uphold the Court of Appeals decision, at least on some grounds, I think what we have here today is this. No pastor in this city ever again can get up and preach any kind of allegory from the Bible about homosexuality. Because if that pastor does, what's going to happen is, if it's not Action Wisconsin, it'll be somebody else that'll sue him. And they'll say, oh, well, this is our interpretation of this. You know, we just feel from reading the speech this is what he was saying. And if I take another lawsuit, then I'm going to be standing up here again with a $90,000 or $100,000 judgment against me. Now, I think the key to this whole lawsuit is this.
Counsel.
Yes.
Is this a case about preaching for or against gays and lesbians, or is this a case of whether this statement put out by Action Wisconsin defamed? Isn't it the latter?
Well, it clearly defamed him. They said he was advocating the murder of gay people. That's defamatory per se.
Under the law, when you got a public figure, don't you need malice? I mean, it could be absolutely false.
Oh,
it could be absolutely hold the person in ill repute.
You do.
But you need malice. So why wasn't there malice here?
Well,
on behalf of Action Wisconsin.
I'll get to that. Here's what I'm going to say.
Good.
The linchpin to me of this whole case is this, and I'll stand behind this to my death. Anybody listening to that speech from start to finish cannot possibly, under any stretch of any imagination, come to the conclusion that when Grant Storms was finishing his allegory about Jonathan and the armor bearer, and he had Jonathan slaying the Philistines and then taking a rest, that statement alone, and that's all they've got, that one statement out of an hour speech, that statement would justify them saying that Grant Storms was advocating the murder of gay people. I don't want anyone up here to forget. What if somebody said about you that you were advocating the murder of a group of people? Does it get more serious than that? They're not saying you're a thief. They're not saying you're a liar. They're not saying that you committed adultery. They're not saying that you beat your kids. Those are all bad, too. They're saying that you're advocating murder. Murder! You're Hitler, basically. You're advocating extermination of a group of people.
What do I do? I listened to the excerpts that were highlighted in the press release and other things around them. I listened to them twice, the different excerpts that are set forth around the turn of the hour, like on 43:40 and 59 minutes and after that. Then I listened to the whole thing after having listened to the relevant excerpts twice. And I don't know, I can't talk about what anyone had in their heart, but certainly the words that came out of Reverend Storm's mouth, I think, could be interpreted as advocating taking them out, so to speak. The ka-ching, 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 go down to McDonald's and get 20 more, ka-ching, boom, boom. I listened carefully when I listened to the whole thing about going through each of the verses. Now, some of the verses were missed when the Reverend Storms went through them. And early on and in the middle, maybe around 25 minutes, he said that this, in essence, this is an allegory comparing the homosexual movement to the Philistines. You know, I mean, he did say that twice. But when you get to the real important stuff towards the hour, when he's saying, you know, Christians, you got to rise up, you got to take to the streets, you can't be like Tiny Tim and tiptoe through the tulips, it's not good enough to sit back and read history, you got to make history. We've crushed them in the legislature and we're going to crush them further. I mean, I think, well, you know, back in the days of Samuel, of course, there weren't any Christians. There wasn't the legislature. There wasn't a McDonald's to go down to. So I can understand the argument that it's an allegory, and maybe it was. But there's also a reasonable interpretation that he's saying Christians take to the streets, don't be, I want to be careful in my choice of words, but don't be like Tiny Tim and tiptoe through the tulips. You know, you got to crush them like we did in the legislature. Why? So what should I do? I mean, I think that's a reasonable interpretation. You say it's implausible. I think it's implausible at all.
I can answer that question. If we go through the whole speech, which I went through in my trial court briefs, the Court of Appeals brief, and the Supreme Court brief, Grant Storms, I think, at 5 different times during his speech, because we've got to look at his speech. Otherwise, anybody up here can interpret. You could come back and say, I said something today that I didn't say, but if you think you heard a few little words in the beginning and a few at the end, then all of a sudden you say, well, you know, Jim Donahue got up there and insulted us. He said, and I go, what? Well, that's according to my interpretation. He said, with God's help, you alone can make a difference no matter what the odds. He said that, I think, 7 times during his speech. At another point, he said, if it's in your heart and it's not sin, it's not sin. Well, everybody knows murder is sin. Then you can do it. He said, don't be spiritually reckless.
You said be wild, though. You said we've got to take to the streets and be wild.
I'll get to that. He said, don't be spiritually reckless. He said, go in there and preach the word of God, the gospel.
Okay. I mean, there are...
Well, no, I think I'd like to go through these. He said, don't get in the flesh. He actually, right after he made the boom, boom, boom remark, which was just part of the story of Jonathan and the Armor Bear, in fact, at the deposition even, Attorney Pines even offered his own explanation at saying the reason Grant Storm said boom, boom, boom was to just enliven up the story of Jonathan killing the Armor Bears. Even opposing counsel admitted that's the only reason he did it.
What was the explanation of boom, boom, boo, go down to McDonald's and take out another 20?
He explained that. The going to McDonald's was just saying a modern-day thing, meaning God was taking a break, because after Jonathan and the Armor Bears, if you listen to the speech, it's all in there. After Jonathan and the Armor Bear slayed the Philistines, they then stop, and then the rest of the Israelis, there was a break there, and then it's like God, you know, quickened the heart of the other Israelis, and then they came in. In fact, right after the boom, 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 Grant Storm talked about how he used to get physical and scratch and claw, and he said, you know, that's not the way it should be. He again stressed that the idea of what he was talking about was that you need to be willing to fight spiritually. He always called it the homosexual movement. He never talked about homosexuals. And when he talked about taking it to the streets, and I've got that in my brief, every time he gave his examples, he meant instead of just writing petitions, do what he did. He went out with a video camera. He videoed this Southern decadence, men having public sex. He took it to the mayor. They passed the law saying that they're 10 days in jail for public sex. He stressed that taking it to the street meant going out and doing things like that. He just stressed it over and over and over again. In the beginning, the middle, and the end of his speech, he stressed those things. So for me, for someone to say, well, he may have said, don't get physical. He may have said this, that, and the other thing. But because he used a few strong words here and there, and because he used one, and because he said boom, 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 therefore, we're going to say that he was advocating the murder of gays. I think that leap is not justified by the law.
Suppose that was a leap, and suppose it's not in the speech. You got a public figure. What do you have to show in a complaint to prove defamation?
And with a public figure, you have to show the normal elements, which I don't think are in question.
Tell me what the normal elements are.
Well, the elements are, you have to show it was defamatory.
Okay.
You have to show it was published to a third party. You have to, there's an issue of whether the statement was true. And that can get down to either whether it actually is true or it's a reasonable interpretation. I'll admit that. Either one of those would qualify as under that standard, and then the final thing is you have to prove when a public figure the actual malice, and that consists of proving
either. Right. So, what's the issue in this case on frivolous? Which of those is it?
Well, the only issue on frivolous was the truth of the statement and whether it was with actual malice.
All right.
And one thing I do need to point out that has never been discussed by Judge McMahon in her trial court decision, and has never been briefed by the opposing side, and I find this rather amazing. Because to me, other than listening to the speech and saying it's just not there, I had four people listen to it. They all said it's not there. And I put that, it's in my affidavit. They all said it's just not there, Jim. It's not there. He didn't say that. Is the deposition testimony of Otten Frecker. This has never even been discussed by anybody but me. Otten admitted that he only listened to approximately 20 minutes of the speech. He said Tim O'Brien listened to the whole thing, but he only listened to 20 minutes. He knew it was an hour speech. He
what then does that go to?
I'm sorry?
What element in defamation does it go to that he
this
didn't
is going
to
go to actual malice, what I'm talking about, that he knew it was false or...
Does everybody in the organization have to listen to the whole thing?
No, but Frecker and Ott are the ones that put out the press release. They're the ones that published it.
At whose orders?
Well, they said at their own orders in their deposition. They said they consulted with O'Brien, but they came to their own opinion, and they're the ones that put it out. O'Brien didn't put it out. It had Joshua Frecker's name on it, and Ott was the executive director.
Okay.
And he said that context was crucial. I asked him, what about context? Context is crucial to understanding the meaning of the speech. Then I said, well, did you listen to the whole speech? No. Listen to 20 minutes. Then he goes on, and he admits, well, by the way, Storms never made any imperative statements in his speech advocating that anybody go out and murder gays. That in order to come to that conclusion, you had to complete the analogy and do some interpretation. So now he admits that no, he didn't say it. Grant Storms didn't say that you should go out and kill gays. But he... Ott himself, with listening to 20 minutes, did some of his own analogy and interpretation, kind of connected the dots, completed the analogy, and then had the gall to put out a press release saying that Pastor Storms was advocating the murder of gay people. Now,
Mr. Donahue, let me ask you about that, because the one thing that I've heard throughout the argument is that there was an advocating of the murder of gays. And I wanted to ask you the import of the language in the complaint that you cite in paragraph 6 of your complaint, which is, I'm sorry, paragraph 2 of, yeah, paragraph 6 of the complaint on page 104 of your supplemental appendix, because it seems to me that this is the language that's being discussed, and I want to focus on the language that's being discussed. In paragraph A, subparagraph A of paragraph 6, another speaker made sounds like gunfire as if he were shooting gay people. And then paragraph B, a speech apparently advocating the murder of his own constituents. Now, given the modifiers in each of those paragraphs, what is the import of those modifiers to the defamation claim?
Well, apparently there's a Wisconsin case on that. It's cited in the Court of Appeals opinion. You can't get out of defamation by just coming up here and saying, well, apparently one of you justices is crazy. But, you know, I said apparently, so, you know, it's a mixed question of fact and law. So apparently...
It must be me.
Apparently gets you nowhere. You can defame with apparently every day of the week. And the second one where he made sounds like gunfire as if he were shooting gay people, well, obviously they're saying, even though he was just giving a biblical example, that's all he was doing. It was his whole speech was on Jonathan and the armor bearer. He never deviated. He never, when he did that, he never said, now I'm going to be shooting gay people. You know, he likened the Philistines to the homosexual movement, but he made it clear in his speech. Again, that's why it's so important. He listened to the whole speech that by comparing them, he was talking about comparing their characteristics, solidarity, stubbornness, the ability to get in there and fight. That's what he was comparing between the two of them.
Which brings my other question. As I understand it historically, and unless I have history all wrong, I don't think there's any question that at least in biblical times, there were no guns and there was no McDonald's. What is the import of that in the speech with respect to the interpretation that has been made here?
Well, the import of that, he explained it. And as I said, Attorney Pines also asked him the question and kind of answered it for him. He just said the boom, boom, boom to just kind of enliven up the proceedings. Attorney Pines in the deposition actually said, and isn't it true, Pastor Storms, that when you made the boom, 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 it was actually to just enliven up the story. Yes, so opposing counsel has answered that question. He even answered it himself, that that's why he said the boom, boom, boom. Just enliven up the story. It had nothing to do with making it sound like gunfire.
Counselor, is the question about whether his statements in the speech are ambiguous a question of fact or question of law?
Well, to say these cases are confusing would be to... I mean, I've been dealing with this for years. My clerk's been dealing with it. We were not... I guess you would have to say probably that if you're going to ask if it was ambiguous here, it would be a question of law, probably, because I guess this is a different defamation case because we have his whole speech out there. Normally in defamation, somebody says something, we've got to go investigate. However, I think what the Court of Appeals was trying to say in their decision, the one thing the Court of Appeals did, and I think it was maybe a mistake, they called these disputed issues of material fact, these various things that I had alleged both in the complaint that I got out of the depositions. And they did that, and they cited in the case based on this Hutchinson versus Proxmire case, which was a U.S. Supreme Court case that said in cases of actual malice, because you got to get inside somebody's mind, even though you may know what they actually said, it may still be a question of fact, meaning what was in their head when they said it. Did they, you know, were they acting with actual malice? And so in those cases, maybe you shouldn't use summary judgment. Now, the Court of Appeals cited that case, and I think that's why they then started characterizing these as disputed issues of material fact. But actually, Hutchinson only had in a footnote, it didn't really decide the case that way. And I believe in Torgerson, Wisconsin did say that even in cases of actual malice, we're going to use summary judgment. I believe that's what Torgerson said. So, I mean, to me, it would be a question of fact, but I think under the Wisconsin law, I guess they're saying that would be a question of law.
Whose malice are we looking for in this case?
Action Wisconsin or Christopher Ott, the people that put out the press release.
What about the concept that you didn't have a reasonable ground to bring this lawsuit? Isn't that what frivolous means?
Well, that's one part, and I set out fully. I mean, I felt I had plenty of grounds, and the Court of Appeal agreed. I had I listened to the speech. I'm like, it's not there. I mean, listen two or three times. It's just like, he didn't say it. Second is I send two retraction letters. I get no response. The third thing is the tenor of the press release itself, which is very political. They're really using Grant Storms as a prop to try and to oppose legislation. They're trying to whip up people, say, oh, this pastor's advocating the murder of gays, Mark Gundrum's, you know, wanted override of AB 475. So they're really using it. Action Wisconsin was the main opponent of the constitutional amendment in Wisconsin. They were the ones that led the charge against trying to get it passed. And they used, you know, they sent this press release out saying he's advocating the murder of gays to the Journal Sentinel. They put it on the internet. They were trying to whip up favor for their position. Also,
they have the right to do that, but they can't be defamatory. Isn't that right?
I'm sorry?
They have a right to exercise political rights, but they cannot be defamatory.
That's correct. That's correct. They can't do it defamatory. And also, and there are cases on these. I know they said I had no cases on anything. Well, the first thing is I don't think you need a case for every argument, do you? I mean, if I'm going to argue that somebody drank and they caused an accident, do I have to get a case? I mean, I know what the jury instruction is. There is little or no case law on actual malice in Wisconsin. There's almost none. And nationwide, there's little or no case law either. And I did cite in my brief, I cited numerous case laws where, you know, failure to investigate can be considered. None of these are, you know, per se, no.
If I understand what you're saying that there's no way his remarks could have been interpreted as advocating murdering or harming gay people. So you're saying it was his speech was not ambiguous, right?
I'm saying the speech was not ambiguous.
Okay, so then what you're saying is there isn't a jury question about whether he was or he was not so advocating, correct? Well, when we talked before, or I asked you before about whether if the speech was ambiguous, it was a question of law or a question of fact, I think you told me that under the law you think it's probably a question of law. And therefore, your position is that there isn't any way this speech is ambiguous because in order to be ambiguous, well, then it can go to the jury, correct? But you're saying the speech isn't ambiguous. There's no way it could have been interpreted the way the defendants interpreted it, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. I just wanted to clear up so I understood your position. Thank you.
So assuming then you are correct, that there's no way this speech could be interpreted as advocating harm, physical harm.
It's in the complaint. It's attached.
Does that end the debate as to whether this publication was defamatory?
Well, it ends the debate whether it's defamatory, but it doesn't end the debate about whether they acted with actual malice.
That's right. Okay,
that's correct.
So let's accept that
absolutely.
For the moment.
I don't have a case, but, you know, the funny thing was...
Just accept for the moment that
that's
their
correct.
Interpretation is
that's not totally good enough.
Wrong. Okay. Now, you say there's malice because... The people who put out the press release did not hear or listen to the whole speech. Is that your point?
No, that's
okay,
not
what
my
is
only
the
point.
Mouse?
That's one of
okay,
my
that's
points.
One
I
of
set
points.
Out a long, detailed description in my brief.
Tell me what pages we're talking about.
The main thing is their deposition testimony. Joshua Frecker said the same thing, actually. He was the communications director of Action Wisconsin. And I think the keynote thing here is when both Frecker and Ott admitted, and I think I needed this element to get over the hurdle, or at least, again, we're just talking about frivolous here. We're not talking about whether I should have won or lost. It could have went to
right.
a jury, and they could have ruled, no, we don't think it's actual malice.
What facts or law show here that there was malice? Because that's what you needed to file this complaint. As I understand this case. So what facts or law did you rely on to file a complaint to show malice? Isn't that the issue?
As to filing the complaint, as I point out, you know,
continuing.
When they didn't answer my retraction letters, I had to start a lawsuit because I couldn't depose them.
Okay. Tell me what facts or law at the time of filing the complaint or thereafter, you had that showed malice, because that's an element in this lawsuit.
Right.
You had to prove.
That's correct.
Okay. So what were they? One, they didn't listen to the whole thing. Okay.
I listened to the speech. Four other people listened to it. Everybody, nobody
that's
believed.
That's not relating to malice. That goes to whether it's
true
or
false. Oh, as to malice?
As to malice. That's the only issue we have.
As to malice was the... if you listen to a speech... And you say nobody could have reasonably made that interpretation to me. That's obviously going to actual malice now because you're saying this statement is false.
All right, let's accept that for the moment.
And
what's your next point?
The ill will, the tenor of the letter itself, the press release, which seemed to be geared towards litigation or geared towards their political purposes, again, which they were trying
political
to use.
Political speech is the most protected speech in this country, as I understand it.
Yes, but if you're using a defamatory statement to try and whip up
right,
people,
right.
the ill will and okay. animus of Ott and Frecker, which came out at their deposition.
What's your next one?
The fact that they both admitted that Grant Storms didn't explicitly or imperatively in his speech advocate the murder of gay people. So they both admitted that at their depositions.
Okay.
You know,
where did this Exhibit 2 come from that's attached to the complaint?
Those were handbills that were pasted on telephone poles down in Louisiana in a place where Grant Storms was going to give a speech. Those were plastered all over the telephone poles.
Thank you. By who? Where did it come from?
I have no reason to believe it was Action Wisconsin, although on the bottom it said to get more information, contact them. But I don't know. I have no idea who posted them.
So you don't know if Action Wisconsin?
No, we never got to that point. I don't know who posted them.
That wouldn't be would that be defamation in Wisconsin if these were posted outside the state?
Well, I wasn't alleging the posters were defamatory.
They were out.
They are, but that I was going just by their press release.
So I have three things listed thus far then. Let's see if I have this right, you say is evidence to show malice. The first is they didn't listen to the whole speech. The second is the ill will that they have towards Storms or his organization. The third is, and they admit it, there is no explicit statement saying go kill gay people or something like that. So those are the three things. Anything else?
It's not a reasonable, I think you said, counsel, that it's not a reasonable interpretation.
Yeah, okay. I thought that was off the board. Assuming that it was not a reasonable interpretation. So you have those three
malice.
Things.
Didn't you indicate that they had not answered the retraction letters?
That's correct.
They didn't answer the retraction letter. Okay, I want to take those four things now. Is there any issue of fact that they did not answer the retraction letter?
No.
Is there any issue of fact that there wasn't an explicit statement tantamount to go out and kill gay people? I don't think there's an issue
of
fact.
Well, Odden Frecker said there wasn't.
Yeah,
in their opinion,
That it was not an explicit statement, as I understand.
That's correct.
There's no issue.
You can't. They couldn't go through the speech and show me anywhere where he said it.
Is there any issue of fact that they may harbor ill will toward your organization?
No, I wouldn't say so. They admitted that they were in their briefs that they were at odds with.
Is there any issue of fact that the Ott did not listen to the entire speech?
No.
Mr. Donahue, what is the standard of review, as you understand it, for determining frivolousness, either for frivolousness to commence or frivolousness to maintain the action?
Well, I actually agree with what Attorney Packard said. I think if you're talking about at the commencement, then it's a discretionary review of the trial court. You have to determine whether the trial court looked at all the relevant facts, which I would contend the trial court here did not look at all the relevant facts. It's obvious from reading my briefs. Whether the court then, you know, also applied the proper standard of law, and then whether the court, you know, showed in their opinion that they had taken these relevant facts and engaged in a rational, analysis and discussion of these facts to come to a conclusion. And again, I'd point out, Judge McMahon never even talked about Otten Frecker admitting that it wasn't in there. How could a trial judge not consider probably one of the most important facts in the whole case? She never even admitted it existed.
As to maintenance?
I'm sorry?
The standard of review as to maintenance of the frivolous action.
Then I think it's as to the facts, they have to be clearly erroneous. But as to applying the facts to the ultimate standard of whether the case was frivolous or not, the court would review that de novo.
Thank you.
Well, as you ticked off these provisions, and as Justice Bradley asked you in question, there is no issue of fact, no disputed issue of fact. Therefore, when there's no disputed issue of fact, the application of the law is a question of law, regardless of commencement or continuing. Or maybe you disagree with that.
Could you say that again?
Yes. There are no disputed facts here, as I understand your view. So why isn't it that, is it still discretionary as to whether this is frivolous under the statute, or is it, I should say the rule, or is it a question of law?
Well, I think this is where the Hutchinson case made a good point, which I agree with. The inferences you're going to draw from undisputed facts sometimes can border on factual issues. In certain cases, I mean, no, if we say, you know, I was driving 2,300 miles an hour drunk, then...
Let me ask, are there any disputed inferences with regard to that Ott did not listen to the entire tape? Any disputed facts or inferences? Are there any disputed facts or inferences that they have ill will towards your organization?
No.
Are there any disputed facts or inferences that it was not explicitly stated, that is, go out and kill gays?
No.
Are there any disputed facts or inferences that they did not respond to your retraction letter?
No.
Counselor, though, aren't you saying that, and aren't they saying that what is implied from the speech, isn't that Action Wisconsin's position that they don't agree that there's no other inference that can be drawn from the speech except this was a biblical allegory? Aren't they saying that it's implied that Storms wanted people to consider harming gay people? Isn't
Action
that the implication they want?
Action Wisconsin is claiming that, I guess they're claiming if you listen to the entire speech, although they never did. The one thing I forgot is that Ott and Frecker both admitted at their depositions, which were a year after the lawsuit was filed, that for the first time they listened to the entire speech the night before their depositions.
Yeah.
But anyway.
But I'm concerned.
I would say that, you know, they're trying to claim that you can listen to Pastor Storm's speech and come to the conclusion that he was advocating the murder of gay people listening to that speech.
What he said is what he said, but I think what's being argued here is that what he said was ambiguous because you could imply from what he said, and it would be a reasonable inference, that he was advocating harming gay people. I mean, isn't that their position?
That's their position, which I think is...
Well, I agree that you don't agree with it, but I was kind of getting to Justice Bradley's asking you all these questions about are there any disputed
If there's more than one rational interpretation, I would stress rational interpretation, then I agree we lose. If their interpretation is rational, supported by reason, from the words in the speech, not just because they want to get Grant Storms, then I agree, then under the case law, at that point, my client... They have a right under Torgerson to pick between, if it's ambiguous, too.
Right.
And this speech isn't ambiguous.
The ambiguity can come in the inferences. It doesn't have to come from the words, he says. You can create ambiguity by inferences, correct?
I want you to finish your sentence. If the Action Wisconsin had a rational interpretation, then we lose. Meaning you lose on attorney
meaning Storms.
Fees.
Well, I guess I lose, too.
Yeah. Okay. So I just want to make sure. And what did summary judgment say about the rational and a reasonable interpretation? Did they say that this was or wasn't?
Well, the court said it was, but ignored everything I had filed. Just basically said, yeah,
but
it's
that's not
rational.
Up on appeal. I just wanted to know what that was.
That's what they
Justice
said.
Justice Bradley, you had a question? Okay.
Thank you.
Counsel, thank you. Mr. Pines?
I have to attack you before you even get started.
Okay.
Is it a question of fact or law whether the interpretation of Action Wisconsin was reasonable?
It's an interpretation of law.
So it's a question of law.
Yes.
Whether it's reasonable. Okay, thank you. That was something.
There is absolutely no dispute about what Grant Storms said, and there is absolutely no dispute about what Action Wisconsin said.
But whether it's reasonable is a question of law. Is
yes.
that correct? Okay.
Justice Prosser, you asked Ms. Packard the question about whether or not this wasn't just an attempt to intimidate a lawyer into not representing an unpopular client. And what I contend is, in fact, the opposite is true. This was an attempt to intimidate an organization which was advocating for a position that Grant Storms did not like. Grant Storms was a public figure. And if he believed that Action Wisconsin had improperly interpreted his speech, he had, at his means, a radio show, the press, the television media, the publicity arm of the Wisconsin Christians United, which sponsored the International Conference Against Homofascism, to respond to Action Wisconsin. But the choice was not to respond with speech. The choice was to respond with a lawsuit. Therein lies the problem, because speech should be met with speech. But when a lawyer representing a public figure decides to go to court and file a lawsuit instead of encouraging his client to respond with speech, he has an obligation to make sure that there is law on which that lawsuit is based. And nothing that Mr. Donahue said here today, nothing that he said in his submission in response to the claim of frivolousness, shows that he did any legal analysis of what needs to be done to prove a public figure defamation case before he filed the case. And he said in his argument, he said, well, they didn't respond to my retraction letter, and so I had to file a lawsuit because then I could take their deposition. But what are the facts of what he did? The lawsuit was filed. He was warned with a letter the day that we answered saying we think this is frivolous. Did he take a deposition? No, he didn't. We took his client's deposition. We sent him another letter, now based on what his client had said, warning him again that this was a frivolous lawsuit. Did he take any depositions? No, he didn't. Did he dismiss the suit? No, he didn't. Then he forced us to file a motion for summary judgment. Only after we filed a motion for summary judgment did he take any depositions. Already 6-7 months into the case. Then he filed a motion for summary judgment that he admitted to Judge McMahon that he did for a tactical purpose only in order to be able to file another brief. And in the course of filing that summary judgment motion, he misquoted, which the court found was deliberate, something from the restatement of torts. And in when he had the opportunity, after the summary judgment was decided and after our motion was before the court, when he had had an opportunity to explain to the court what he did, he put in an affidavit which said, I knew what the elements were, and I looked at the restatement of torts, and he really didn't say very much else. And that affidavit is in the appendix at 78. If you look at that affidavit, it is an explanation made by a lawyer who did no legal analysis, not before he filed the lawsuit, not after he got a warning letter, not after he got another warning letter, not after he read our summary judgment motion. The merits, the judge decided, she said there was nothing here. She gave Mr. Donahue every opportunity to explain how it was that he figured out legally that there was actual malice here, and he could explain nothing. And he has explained nothing in this court. What he has done here is to come in here and to try to obfuscate this entire case by talking about Reverend Storms and saying to you, no pastor is safe. Reverend Storms was not speaking at a religious meeting. He was speaking at a political meeting. And what he said at that meeting was, it's us or them, and I'm quoting from the appendix at page 51, the decision of Judge McMahon, it's us or them. There is no in-between. There is no having this peaceful coexistence. Either they'll crush us and silence us and kill the ones that won't be silent or imprison the ones that won't be silent. That's what he said. He likens the homosexual movement to the Philistines. He tells a story from the Bible about the conflict between the Israelites and the Philistines, in which Jonathan, after the Israelite army isn't doing anything, Jonathan on his own gets up and kills 20 Philistines, which then rouses the Israelite army to go and kill the rest of the Philistines. And then he says, and Jonathan killed 20. Jonathan killed 20 Philistines. And then he says, boom, 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 boom. There's 20. Ka-ching. Let's take a break and come back and get the rest. And then Attorney Donahue comes in here and says, the reason I filed this lawsuit is because there is no way anybody else could possibly ever have interpreted that as encouraging that crowd to kill gay and lesbian people. And in fact, the allegory itself is palpable. There's Jonathan. He rises up. He kills 20. There's a break. The Israelites kill the rest. Action Wisconsin was perfectly reasonable in putting out the press release that it did. Grant Storms was a public figure. He spoke at a political rally. He spoke in the midst of a hotly contested political issue. And if he didn't like Action Wisconsin's interpretation, all he had to do was speak. And the question was, and I forget who asked the question, why Attorney Donahue and why not Grant Storms? It's because the attorney who represents a public figure has an obligation to make sure that before he files a lawsuit, that he knows what the law is, he's read the law, he knows there's a legal basis for these facts, and then he files the lawsuit, and if something's going wrong during the lawsuit, he figures out that too. But what Attorney Donahue did, and what Judge McMahon said, and she's correct, is he dropped these papers into the legal hopper and let everybody else spend the time and the effort and the money to sort it out. That is why this case was frivolous.
Red light's on.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Packard and Mr. Pines and Mr. Donahue, for your argument in this defamation case. And First Amendment cases are always very interesting and very difficult. So that closes the hearing on 06-AP-396, Donahue versus Action Wisconsin. I'm going to take a few minutes of a break in order for the Barneveld High School students to leave if they wish, and we will be having West Salem High School students enter the court.